Welcome to the Hanover Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Hanover Messianic Ministries Director, Pastor Bob Morris, will continue tracing important events in the history of the modern state of Israel. Pastor Bob will take up a discussion of the War of Attrition that lasted from 1968 until 1972. Then he'll begin an explanation of the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Hanover Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now, let's begin lesson number 14. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Well, I'd like to welcome you to lesson 14 of our course, our class, The First Regathering, Modern Israel. We have just finished going through the 1967 Six-Day War in Lesson 13, a war that was an astounding military victory for the Israelis. In 6 days, the Egyptian Air Force was decimated. The Sinai Peninsula was captured by Israel, the entire West Bank captured by Israel, and the Golan Heights. We also briefly looked at the political resolution to the Six-Day War, which was UN Security Council Resolution 242, and I finished up our class last time by pointing out that under Resolution 242, the Arab states are required to recognize the existence of the State of Israel, and that 242 does not demand that Israel return to a state of insecurity. Israel's security needs are acknowledged, and the border that she sets up does not have to be exactly the same as pre-1967. Okay, now we move into the year 1968, and we'll take a look at the War of Attrition with Egypt, the War of Attrition. Now, troubles began to brew for Nasser following his defeat in the Six-Day War. Domestic unrest began to surface, and in October of 1968, riots erupted in Egypt. As Nasser saw it, vindication by war was the one sure method of strengthening his hand within his own country. In fact, his hand was being strengthened at that time by the Russians. They viewed Israel's pulverizing victory in the Six-Day War as an intolerable challenge to their own leadership in the Middle East. From that moment, from the moment the ceasefire came into effect, the Soviets proceeded to reinstate large-scale arms deliveries to the Middle East. And so a pattern of violence along the Suez Canal accordingly began to develop in erratic sequences. The initial phase was from the end of the war until April of 1969. That was the initial phase. It was characterized by sporadic outbursts that grew in intensity and frequency as the Egyptians recovered from their 1967 disaster. Each Egyptian probe from the west bank of the canal, they fired from the west bank of the canal because Israel was on the east bank of the canal. Each Egyptian probe evoked a tough counterblow from the Israelis. Now, the canal offered each side a first-rate defensive barrier, and by autumn of 1968, a military standoff had developed. October 1968 marked a turning point in the rising crescendo of Suez fighting. In a single afternoon, a massive Egyptian artillery barrage killed 15 Israelis and demonstrated that Egypt had accumulated a vastly superior number of men and equipment on the west bank of the canal, vastly superior numbers of men and equipment. And from then until the late summer of 1969, the intensity of Egyptian shelling steadily mounted. And the revived hostilities swiftly developed into an overt Egyptian war of attrition. Nasser's goal was to prevent the transformation of the canal into a de facto border. De facto means that to actually exercise power, though not legally or officially established by a government. So what he wanted to eliminate was the fact that the Suez Canal would become the border of Egypt and Israel, even though it had not been formally set up as such. Nasser's goal was to prevent the transformation of the canal into a de facto border. So he accomplished this by inflicting He planned to accomplish this by inflicting such heavy casualties that the Israelis would be forced back into the Sinai, or he hoped they would be compelled to accept a political situation on Arab terms. So the lethal Egyptian bombardment of October 1968 dictated a modified defensive approach. In order to stay entrenched at the canal, the Israelis began digging into hardened concrete and steel reinforced bunkers, and they created fortified positions. Those fortified positions were subsequently known as the Bar-Lev Line, after Israel's chief of staff, then Chaim Bar-Lev, General Chaim Bar-Lev. With the completion of the fortifications in March of 1969, the Israeli general staff expected to be able to withstand the developing war of attrition. Now, to reverse the heavy casualty trends that Israel was suffering from the bombardments, Israel, in late July 1969, launched sustained air bombardments of Egyptian guns on the west bank of the canal. For 3 months, the Israeli planes battered away at the enemy emplacements. And gradually, Egyptian positions along the waterway were silenced, and Israeli losses dropped markedly. On January 22, 1970, Nasser paid a visit to Moscow. He informed the Soviet leadership that the Israelis, in an effort to relieve pressure on the Bar-Lev line, were now bombing Egyptian artillery emplacements west of the canal. They were also bombing targets deep in the Nile Valley. A consequence of this far-reaching aerial activity was the evacuation of some 500,000 Egyptian civilians from the canal zone, as well as the exposure of the Egyptian interior to Israeli incursions that were both military damaging and politically humiliating. A third, 33% of the Egyptian fighter force already had been shot down by enemy planes. The morale of his troops was virtually on the edge of collapse at this time. Well, the Soviets agreed to participate more actively in defending Egyptian military and civilian targets. And by mid-February, the Soviet airlift traffic to Egypt had increased 4 times above the ordinarily high level. Within 6 months, the Russians had between 10,000 and 14,000 of their own instructors and advisors in Egypt, as well as an impressive naval flotilla, 60 vessels off the Egyptian coast. This was an armada that matched the U.S. Sixth Fleet in tonnage and surface firepower. Additionally, Soviet pilots were flying reconnaissance missions from Egyptian bases. Others were on interception alert at Egyptian airfields, and Soviet units manned SAM-3 anti-aircraft missile sites. For Israel, the most crucial development was intelligence information that the Soviet pilots were assuming responsibility for air defense over the Nile Valley. And accordingly, in April of 1979, the Israelis suspended their deep penetration raids. The Egyptians, in turn, began moving new SAM missile batteries toward the canal. By the end of June 1970, Soviet aviators were flying combat patrols on both the northern and southern outlets of the canal. The Egyptian-Soviet defense system was further thickened with the introduction of SAM-4 and SAM-6 missiles. And before these new rockets were detected on June 30th, they managed to shoot down 2 Israeli Phantom jets. Early in July, they brought down an additional 5 Phantoms over the west bank of the canal. As the Israelis encountered these Soviet tactics and a seemingly inexhaustible supply of enemy missile batteries, they recognized that they were facing their gravest military crisis since the week immediately preceding the 1967 war. By the end of July, Israel had suffered more than 3,000 casualties since the 1967 war. And then there was another side of the picture. The Egyptians had taken a fearful battering of their own. Since April 1970, they had lost over 10,000 casualties to Israeli air and military action. Now, in September of 1970, Nasser died of a heart attack. This allowed Anwar al-Sadat to come to power in Egypt. And the ascension of Anwar al-Sadat allowed Jerusalem for the first time to anticipate a new and possibly more moderate stance from Egypt. On May 27, 1971, came the revelation of a new and wide-ranging treaty between Egypt and the Soviet Union. Early in 1972, Agreement was also reached between the U.S. and Israel to supply Israel with American Phantom jets and other sophisticated electronic equipment. By the spring of that year, the Israeli Air Force had assured itself superiority not only over its Egyptian counterpart, but over the Egyptian-Soviet defense network. And Cairo recognized this. Egypt recognized this. This accounted for the mounted frustration of the Egyptian government and eventually a crisis in relations between Sadat and the Kremlin leadership. Moscow's goal was a permanent military base in Egypt to be used for its own strategic and regional purposes. The Kremlin was not interested in direct military involvement in the conflict with Israel. They did not want to create their own Middle Eastern Vietnam, and Sadat was angered at this. He wanted them to apparently be much more aggressive against Israel. He retaliated with an ultimatum on July 13, 1972, telling the Soviets to withdraw their advisors and their instructors. And to the astonishment of both Washington and Israel, the Russians evacuated the largest part of their personnel from Egypt, and the war of attrition collapsed at that point. Now let's take a look at 1973. We'll move up to 1973 and the Yom Kippur War. The war of attrition has collapsed in 1972, but Israel is not out of danger. Her biggest danger in 1973 was complacency. In 1973, the elections for the Israel's 8th Knesset drew near, and these placards greeted the Israeli public as the elections approached. And let me quote, "There is peace on the banks of the canal and in the Sinai Desert, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, Judea, Samaria, and on the Golan. The lines are safe, the bridges are open, Jerusalem is united, new settlements have been established, and our political position is stable. This is the result of a balanced, bold, and far-sighted policy. You know that only the labor alignment could have accomplished this." A little bit of political propaganda, isn't it? This propaganda expressed the mood of the nation, a mood of national security, a mood of prosperity. And it was not undeserved. In the autumn of 1973, Israel's economy sustained its upward momentum. The gross national product continued to grow at an annual rate of 10%. Employment opportunities were so wide and so widespread that even 130,000 Arab workers commuted from the administered territories, and they didn't take up the slack. Evidence of the boom was everywhere. There were high-rise apartment buildings going up, luxurious new villas being built, a forest of television antennas cropping up on houses. Shops were crowded. Roads and highways were choked with 370,000 private vehicles in a population of less than 3 million. And all this was in addition to unprecedented security at home. It was little wonder that the electoral campaign was taking place in an atmosphere devoid of survivalist urgency, in an atmosphere that bordered on complacency. In the early September of 1973, a new political party came into being. It was the right-center bloc entitled Likud, Unity. The Likud party was dominated by Menachem Begin. On the military scene, self-assurance reflected and influenced Israel's military posture. Laxity began to taint all facets of the defense structure. Israel's self-assurance, plainly, was not weakened by the death of Nasser in September of 1970. Israel's self-assurance was not weakened by the choice of Anwar Sadat as his successor. Sadat had a relaxed approach. His involvement seemed to be focused on domestic concerns, and this seemingly gave hope for peace in the Middle East. Yet for all his outward demeanor, his graciousness, his generosity, the new president was laying the groundwork for a confrontation with Israel from the very onset of his presidency. For one thing, Egypt's economic needs, its population explosion, dictated the vital importance of opening the Suez Canal and rebuilding canal cities. See, the war of attrition had closed the waterway. So early in October of 1971, Sadat instructed his military command to prepare to cross the canal. The president warned his countrymen in the following May of 1972 that a showdown with Israel was inevitable and that he was prepared to, quote, sacrifice 1 million men in the forthcoming war. Few in Israel gave heed to Sadat's warnings, particularly after July 1972, when he ordered the removal of Soviet advisors from Egypt. Sadat then embarked on building a common strategy with the Arab camp. He had little difficulty with President Hafez al-Assad of Syria, and it was the expulsion of Soviet advisors from Egypt in July 1972 that strengthened Assad's hand as a rebuke to Sadat, and in an effort to consolidate their position in the Middle East, the Soviets decided to ship unprecedented quantities of military equipment to Syria. And now Syria would become the most heavily armed nation per capita in the Arab world. Now, extensive plans were laid for a two-pronged attack under Egyptian strategic command. Sadat himself visited Damascus on May and June to confirm the arrangements. Sadat then won over Faisal of Saudi Arabia, and he mended fences with Hussein of Jordan. He even won the assurance of Soviet military backing. So throughout the summer of 1973, the Soviets accelerated their arms shipments to Syria, and in the early fall embarked on a massive new delivery program to Egypt. Plans were made for a wartime airlift. Now, in the week of October 6th, the week before October 6th, I should say, the Soviets launched 5 new Cosmos satellites into an orbit to photograph Israeli defenses in the north and the south. Then, too, a Soviet electronics intelligence ship was sailing toward Egypt. The families of Soviet advisors in Egypt and Syria were evacuated. October 6th was decided upon as the most advantageous date for the attack. They reasoned that the Israelis would be preoccupied with their election campaigns. They would be worshiping and fasting on their holy day of Yom Kippur. They would hardly expect an attack during the Muslim festival of Ramadan. But everything depended on simultaneous initiative and surprise. Now, the Israelis were by no means oblivious to the scope of these maneuvers, nor were they unaware of the fact that large quantities of men and equipment were being accumulated along the waterway. It didn't escape them that in the north, the Syrians were methodically augmenting their tank and military forces, and triple lines of defense had been constructed across the Golan Plain to the outskirts of Damascus. And for the time being, the Israeli general staff persuaded itself that these maneuvers and reinforcements were essentially defensive. In the south, they were interpreted as yet another gambit in Sadat's annual war of nerves. And Sadat and his advisors did much to foster the illusion. For one thing, the Egyptian president had been announcing the moment of decision with such frequency during the past 2 years that it was difficult to take seriously any of these warnings. Now, in the last months before October, Anwar Sadat intensified his deception. He allowed reports to be circulated of growing tensions between Egypt and the Soviet Union. He allowed reports of Soviet unwillingness to provide Egypt with new weaponry following the 1972 expulsion of the Russian advisors. And Israel believed these reports. On October 3rd, Prime Minister Golda Meir held a cabinet meeting with her defense and military commanders, Moshe Dayan, Yigdal Alon, Israel Galili, and others. And they unanimously agreed that war was not imminent. In fact, Israeli intelligence had all the necessary data on Arab preparations and deployment. They knew all that was going on. The failure was in the evaluation. Reaction to the Arab concentration of forces came belatedly, indeed, not until October 5th, the very eve of the Yom Kippur War. It was then and then only that the Israelis were faced with overwhelming evidence of large-scale Arab preparations. It was then, and only then, that the General Staff agreed to declare an alert. At 4 a.m. the next day, Israeli and American monitors had intercepted the unmistakable radio signals of final Arab war preparations. Immediately, Dayan and General Elazar, the Chief of Staff, was notified and informed that 0 hour evidently would come in 14 short hours. At 5 o'clock, the General Staff commanders were meeting at the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv. 100,000 Armored Corps personnel began assembling. The men at the Suez Canal were ordered to withdraw to their fortifications and to keep alert. They did this in a leisurely fashion, refusing to take seriously the notion of a major attack. Many of the troops were inexperienced young reservists. Large numbers of trained regulars had been given leave for Yom Kippur, another lethal mistake. From his headquarters in Nazareth, General Yitzhak Hofi, the Northern Front commander, issued orders for an alert. That alert was observed laxly, reflecting the erosion of military discipline since 1967. At 2 p.m., the Israeli cabinet gathered in an emergency session, and a military aide suddenly entered the conference room and whispered urgently to Mrs. Meir that the enemy onslaught had begun. We begin with the Northern War with Syria. And when it began with a vengeance. Thousands of shells and bombs exploded along the eastern bank of the canal and along the entire ceasefire line of the Golan Heights. Enemy planes roared overhead, strafing deep behind Israel's forward positions. Israel quickly lost her radar surveillance fortification on top of the 6,000-foot Mount Hermon. Now, in the Golan, it was an earthquake of an assault. After a 55-minute artillery barrage, two Syrian armored divisions of 800 tanks and three infantry divisions in personnel carriers began rumbling across the ceasefire line. The Israeli defenders were hopelessly outnumbered. They fought as if berserk. They inflicted heavy losses, but all they did was delay the steady advance. The Israelis were eventually reduced to six tanks. On the evening of October 8th, the Syrians unleashed another devastating artillery barrage, and a new force of 600 heavy tanks emerged from the smoke, followed by even larger waves of armored personnel carriers. The shadow of a new Holocaust descended upon Israel. However, as it developed, the Syrians in this last effort had expended everything. They were out of supplies, and they needed to be equipped badly. As Israeli reinforcements slowly began to crawl up the Golan, they began to maul the Syrian supply convoys with pinpoint gunnery. The supply convoys suddenly began turning in their tracks and running. That left the frontline troops without firepower, and they began to flee as well. The bludgeoned Israeli defenders shook off their exhaustion. They managed to round up 20 tanks, and they made mincemeat of the Syrian armor and personnel carriers as they pursued them. A handful of dazed and flogged youngsters in a scattering of battered tanks had lifted the shadow of certain catastrophe from the nation. On the 10th, the Israeli counterattack began. Israel had forced the Syrians back to the initial ceasefire lines. Nevertheless, it was recognized that the Syrian army could not be allowed to recover and absorb equipment pouring in from the Soviet Union. On the evening of the 10th, the General Staff agreed it was necessary to penetrate at least 12 miles beyond the ceasefire line. Only then could the Syrians be neutralized as a factor in the war. The 7th Armored Brigade was given the honors, and in less than 24 hours, the Syrians showed signs of breaking. By October 18th, Israel commanded the flat terrain extending to the outskirts of Damascus, only 22 miles away. The suburbs of the city lay within artillery range. It was a good place to consolidate forces. Although Arab counterattacks were mounted each day thereafter against the Israeli wedge, the Israelis launched no further offensive action against the Syrian capital. On the night of October 20, orders were transmitted to recapture the heights of Mount Hermon, and this was accomplished by dawn on October 22nd, and the radar eyes of Israel had been restored. Let's take a look at the Southern War with Egypt. Some 230 miles to the southwest during the same grim hours of October 6 and 7, the Israelis were tasting the power of one of the largest standing armies in the world. Positioned along the canal were five Egyptian infantry divisions, three mixed infantry and tank divisions, and 22 independent infantry, commando, and paratroop brigades. With the Air Force, the enemy constituted not less than 600,000 men, 2,000 tanks, 2,300 artillery pieces, 160 SAM missile batteries, and 550 combat planes. Facing this war machine in the Sinai, along the 110 miles of canal, were precisely 436 Israeli soldiers in a series of bunkers 7 to 10 miles apart, together with three tanks, and seven artillery batteries. The fortifications, of course, are known as the Bar-Lev Line. At 2 o'clock on October 6th, as Sadat's planes attacked air bases and radar stations behind Israeli lines, the full weight of Egyptian military artillery opened up along the entire front. For the next 53 minutes, the skeletal Israeli contingents on the East Bank fortifications endured murderous shelling. When the barrage reached its crescendo, the first wave of 8,000 Egyptian infantry moved across the waterway on fiberglass boats. There was little the shell-shocked Israeli reservists in the fortifications could do to halt the crossings. By nightfall, no fewer than 30,000 Egyptian infantrymen had attained a foothold throughout the eastern length of the canal, and new units pushed forward, some to a depth of 3 miles. That night, 11 pontoon bridges went up across the water, and tanks began moving over. Within 24 hours of the initial offensive, five Egyptian infantry and armored divisions had taken up positions 3 miles east of the canal, entirely outflanking the Bar-Lev line, which they anticipated taking at their convenience. General Shazly expected his army to suffer as many as 10,000 casualties. Instead, Egyptian dead at the first stage totaled 180. Early on October 9th, the Israeli counterattack in the southern sector had begun. Israeli forces were resuming their traditional coordination, their traditional flair. However, this initial attempt to destroy the Egyptian foothold failed with heavy losses. Thus, on October 10th, the battle line stabilized, with Israel holding its own and the Egyptians temporarily digging in east of the Suez Canal. At this time, 70,000 enemy troops had crossed the waterway and established an unbroken front 6 miles in depth. By October 14th, the Israelis had reinforced their strength with 430 tanks. At dawn on the 14th, preceded by a 90-minute artillery bombardment, the Egyptians launched their full strength westward. The Israelis saw a huge cloud of dust moving toward them. The battle lasted half a day, and it was a slaughter. Over 250 Egyptian tanks were destroyed within the first 2 hours of combat. When the Egyptians attempted to bring infantry forward with their armored personnel carriers, their hundreds of armored personnel carriers, they were similarly liquidated. The expert Israeli tankers then cut off the retreat of the Egyptian stragglers, knocking out another 55 tanks without a single loss of their own. Firing died down by 3 p.m. Israel had won an armored victory that exceeded Montgomery's triumph over Rommel in World War II. In addition, a seam had opened up between the Egyptian Second Army in the north and the Third Army in the south. By coincidence, and this is a divine coincidence, this seam coincided with the staging area that Ariel Sharon had prepared years before. The staging area had been developed in 1968 as part of Israeli preparations to counterattack across the canal if needed. A crossing was then authorized. Ariel Sharon would take a brigade across. The crossing went rather poorly. By 9 a.m. on October 15th, a mere 30 tanks and 2,000 men had reached the west bank of the canal. However, the Egyptian command, when informed of the small numbers, assumed that a small Israeli raiding party was running loose. They didn't even bother to react. In God's providence, even a poorly executed military maneuver worked out to Israel's advantage. By October 17th, Israeli tanks had fought their way to the crossing point Pontoon bridges were erected, and Israeli tanks began to rumble en masse into Egypt. Only then did Cairo wake up to the fact that Sharon's initial small crossing was far more than a raid. Israeli armor began systematically destroying Egyptian missile batteries and tearing holes in the Egyptian air defenses. The divisions ground ahead at full tilt through the Egyptian Third Army's West Bank supply lines. I see now that our time is coming to a close for this class. So why don't we call it quits here at the very end of the Yom Kippur War. We'll pick it up on our next class, and we'll take a look at the final result of the Yom Kippur War in 1973.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Hadavar Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries.